Earning your degree online doesn't mean you have to go about it alone. At Capella University, we're here to support you when you're ready. From enrollment counselors who get to know you and your goals, to academic coaches who can help you form a plan to stay on track, we care about your success and are dedicated to helping you pursue your goals. Going back to school is a big step, but having support at every step of your academic journey can make a big difference. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.
Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you sell everywhere, from their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system. Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. What I love about Shopify is how no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify gives you everything you need to take control and take your business to the next level. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. And Shopify is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/westwoodone, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/westwoodone now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/westwoodone.
Oh my goodness. And Elliot, we're back with some more animation.
Yes,
you gotta have like a big, like exciting intro when it's like animation episode of Film Detectives.
Cue the Hans Zimmer cues now, right? So today, guys, we're going to talk about Hayao Miyazaki's two great masterpieces, Nausicaa, The Valley of the Wind, and also The Wind Rises. His very supposedly last film that he was going to retire on, but actually he's back and directing again. Found that out. He actually just directed a film in 2016, How Do You Live, which I actually have to still have to see. But The Wind Rises is kind of like his swan song to end his career sort of thing. And it's this homage to Jiro Hirokoshi, who designed the Japanese Zero airplane during World War II. Yeah. So a little bit of a backstory with Hayao Miyazaki. So he was born in 1941. So he kind of came from that era of the post-war directors that were born after or during World War II and then grew up during the war and then were influenced by how that war affected pretty much everyone's lives at the time. Yeah. Especially, you see it in The Wind Rises, definitely heavily influenced by how the war affected Japan itself, having to go through a war with several major nations, America, the Netherlands, and also being a pretty much like a prisoner of war in a way to the aftermath of what happened in World War II after the nuclear bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mm-hmm. So, and it's interesting because Japan's films, a lot of films that come out of Japan post-war and up to now are really, they really have this theme of being afraid of the post-apocalyptic, what is the worst case scenario? Because they've lived through having two atomic bombs dropped on their cities. And It shows in their artwork, it shows in their films. And I think Miyazaki's just channeling a lot of that fear that came along with that and also not knowing what the next day holds.
Well, even in, you know, Nausicaa, his first film on The Valley of the Wind, or, you know, early films, you see the whole effect of, it's more, much more, you know, on the nose in The Wind Rises because it's literally about building the Japanese Zeros for World War II. Mm-hmm. But even in Nausicaa, you have, you know, the Ohms who are basically, you know, inhabiting an area and these people come in and are like, oh, they're bad, let's destroy them type of thing. So you still have that sense of like, you know, war and peace. And a big thing he really focuses on, I feel like, is the environment. And he's an environmentalist because he's really saying in that film, like, why can't we just leave nature alone?
Right.
Because anything we touch is, when we touch it as human beings, and you could say that for, you know, the current world we live in, we destroy.
Yeah.
We're a destructive species. Human beings are very destructive, especially with the world.
As Agent Smith said, you're like a virus. We just consume everything. I mean, if you think about it, yeah, we are a very destructive race, and there's very few voices in this particular, human race that like really are proponents for coexisting with nature and learning to live with what's around you and work and live off the land. And that kind of also stems from, I believe, like with Miyazaki, it really stems from the Japanese culture, from Shintoism and Buddhism being already heavily, deeply rooted in this culture itself. And then he's just channeling that through his own films. And because he at heart, Miyazaki is a pacifist. He's an environmentalist. He's a feminist. He, you know, his films deal with love, family themes that really are important to him. And then come through his work, because, I mean, we see it in Princess Mononoke. We see it in Castle in the Sky. We see it in Spirited Away. Like pretty much every film, Nausicaä kind of starts it, even though he started with in 1979, he directed his first film, The Castle of Cagliostro. I'm going to probably butcher the name. Cagliostro. Yeah. The Castle of Cagliostro.
I would like to buy a vowel.
Yes, please give me a vowel here.
Solve the puzzle.
But that was his first film, and then he went on to direct Nausicaä. Nausicaä is, I really think, him really developing the Miyazaki style.
Style, yeah.
Because he really has a stylistic vision to his films, in that they somehow center around humans coexisting with nature in some capacity or learning to coexist with each other. There's also an industrial complex that kind of crops up too, where there's a certain culture or people that end up being like the opposing force and will try to destroy what has been set to be like a beautiful cohabitation between humans and nature. And then there's some force that comes in and destroys that connection.
And a great example of that is at the end of the film, when they're having the giant battle scene with the Ohms, they're trying to resurrect that one being, and they do it way too early.
Right.
And that's something, you know, we especially now as a human race, don't like to wait for anything. We're always, you know, like wanting it now. And this was back in 1984.
Yeah.
And here you have,
and Miyazaki's
in the film, it's like
warning about it.
Yeah. It's like, don't rush, you know, and it also kind of goes in with nature too, right? Like nature is a thing that takes place over many years, and it's a beautiful thing. Like you think about the seasons and things like that, they're never rushed. They're always on that certain timetable that, you know, the fall happens in that set amount of months, the trees lose all their leaves, and then you have the new, you know, the seeds and everything get spread around. What is that? That's not pollination. Germination. What it's called, right? Germination. Yeah. Pollination is the other one.
Yeah.
So you have the germination, and then you have the spring where the new growth happens.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of nature. It takes time for things to develop and create. They don't just happen like, you know, in a night. A tree doesn't just sprout up and become a redwood in one night.
The like pretty much humanity tries to hasten that timetable, and they want change to happen immediately. And
that's what he's really, you know, that's one of the biggest things he's saying in the film, I feel like, is because they're all like, we're going to get this, you know, giant creature that was once there, and we're going to let it out, but we let it out way too early. So it just crumbles and dies.
Right.
Which we do that a lot in the world with nature. We ruin a lot of things like we've talked about.
Yeah. I mean, like we're destroying the rainforest right now. We're destroying, you know, we're trying to pollute the earth as much as we can and just rip it of its resources. And, you know, if we don't, not to get too preachy with this, but, you know, like if you go to a certain point and you keep doing that, it's, you're going to end up with nothing on the earth. And we're already kind of seeing that change already with, you know, global warming, the climates have been changing, and you know, we're now feeling the effects of that meddling that humans have done. So yeah, I think Miyazaki was always especially all the way back in 1984, you know, it's his way of telling people like, hey, we need to really respect nature, and not destroy it.
This is back in the 80s too, and here we are in 2021, and that message was, and this is something you touched on that I think is really cool, that each director we've watched, you know, their first film, it seems like they're kind of figuring out their style, and then when we watch another film of theirs, for example,
later
on, Rises, you see how they've, you know, just grown, and like you said, you know, he found his style per se.
Yeah.
His actual,
by the time
his
he
actual.
Yeah. By the time he gets to The Wind Rises, it's Miyazaki on steroids, and he's literally got all the tools that he needs to create a beautiful animated feature film. I mean, mm-hmm. the animation is some of the best animation I've ever seen. It's 2D animation, and it's so lifelike. That's the thing, is with the Miyazaki, like I told you before, like when we were watching even Nausicaa, the way Miyazaki draws and animates water is this mm-hmm. very fluid, dreamlike quality to it. But in a sense, it feels real. It's a realistic motion that the water in the films that he has directed and animated look that way. And that's one of his archetypes that he has in his films. And you see that also in how he does wind, even when it comes to The Wind Rises. It's becomes a character unto itself in The Wind Rises.
You brought up there's like a flow and a motion to it. You know, there's a movement. And that, I think that's a beautiful way to describe his work. There's always motion. There's always something happening. And it's, you know, it could be as subtle as the wind blowing, you know, when the wind rises across the grass and you see the little, you know, different blades of grass moving with feet, and then all the wind, or the, maybe the clothes are moving. Or in Nausicaa, there's, like you said, the water. There's also just moments where, you know, there's the bugs and stuff flying through the air, and you see the little bit of the you know, motion of the wind there and things like that. There's just all those little moments that are give so much life to I almost like stagnant picture in a way, right?
He's almost like an alchemist in a way, because he's mixing earth, wind, and fire and water.
The four nations.
Yeah, Avatar. But you know, you see the influence of where Avatar got a lot of its inspiration from too, because mm-hmm. I mean, like a lot of animators draw from Miyazaki. I mean, even feature live action films draw from Miyazaki. It's you know, in their framing, in their themes, or in the way they build their characters and such. What I thought was really interesting, that on second view, actually third or fourth view actually, of The Wind Rises, the quote, "The wind is rising and we must try to live," really stood out to me, because that pretty much sums up the film and mm-hmm. what the character of Jiro is going through all the turmoil in his life, because he's basically seeing his country crumble and fall and fall to the war industrial complex.
And on top of that, his wife.
And his wife, too.
Deteriorate. Just like the country.
Yep, exactly. Which, in a sense, you could even say that's an allegory for Mother Nature deteriorating. All that's pure and beautiful that in the character's life, you know, deteriorates and dies, but the wind keeps going, which I thought was, it's again, that sense, the wind is almost akin to time itself and the passage of time.
Did you read my notes, Elliot?
I think I might've.
I think you did. Cause literally what I was going to say is at the very end of the film, I don't want to spoil it, cause you need to watch it.
Yes.
But there's the big moment where, you know, that one person says one thing to the other person, and then there's the big credit scene or whatever. And we were talking about this last night, even with going into video games, Ghost of Tsushima used wind like crazy. It's, you know, it's a game that focuses on the Japanese samurai, correct?
Yes.
And they use wind to kind of tell the story, and wind is very almost like a spiritual thing. And even in The Wind Rises as well. But the wind, like you said, you know, is always going. It's never stopping. Just like mm-hmm. with time and life, we're always moving forward.
Yeah.
And the wind changes directions, just like with our life. Yep. We change directions all the time. And things happen. You get blown to this side or blown to this side, or you're on a nice straight path, and all of a sudden a big gust just takes you and moves you to some other part.
Exactly.
And it's beautiful that the wind is such a central character. Like you said, it's almost like its own character in The Wind Rises.
Yeah.
Just adding the wind in pretty much every type of scene where you see there's extra movement, it adds so much more life to the shots and things we're seeing.
It makes the film feel more organic and more in touch with the nature aspect of what Miyazaki is trying to portray in this film. I mean, even down to how he does the sound design. Miyazaki in this film chose to pick very organic sound. It almost sounds like people in the studio just doing the sound effects with their voice.
Walking on grass or, you know, walking on the floor.
Or the sound of steam. It was mainly for the sound of the airplanes and the steam or some mechanical sounds. A lot of those were, it sounded like someone just vocalizing it, which I thought was a very interesting way to sound design, because in a sense, Jiro, it's like a child mentality. When we're kids, we, you know, reenact playing with airplanes, just like, you know, doing machine gun noises and, you know, but that's what I think he wanted to get, that sense of being brought back to your youth when you were, you have that innocence and you're, and an airplane is just an airplane. It's not a machine of death.
Absolutely. Because at the end of the film, Jiro is like, I never knew I built those planes for war.
Yeah.
Like he just wanted it because he loved airplanes.
Yeah. But he loved the beauty of it.
Yeah. But he ended up creating a monster, basically.
Exactly. Well, look at the guys who signed on to, you know, develop the atomic bomb. Or rockets. Even the Germans, when they were developing rockets and stuff, Wernher von Braun said, you know, I don't care if it, you know, killed millions of people. I got to build rockets. And then we ended up tapping the scientists from the Germans after the war, you know, to make our rockets and such. So it's the industrial war complex is so evident, and we're still feeling the effects from World War II to this day, and still trying to figure out, you know, the pacifists around the world are still trying to figure out how do we learn to coexist with one another and not have to rely on machinery and these basically tools of war that will weapons of mass destruction that will kill millions of people or can't have the potential to kill millions of people.
And that's the thing, right? You know, if we ever, I hope we never get to that point where we have a war these days of that proportion of what we had back then, because the amount of power we have now that countries have now compared to back then, it's terrifying to think about.
Well, okay. So two scenes. One scene in The Wind Rises after the earthquake, when you see basically the whole city, like the whole city where Jiro is from, totally reduced to ash because of the fires that have erupted because of the earthquake that happens in Tokyo, I believe. You know, it literally decimates that city to its like cinder blocks. And
yeah,
it's a haunting image of what Nagasaki and Hiroshima were, and also what the aftermath of those bombs being dropped on those cities was. And then we also see it also in Nausicaä with how it's humanity recovering from a post-apocalyptic event where humanity basically destroyed itself and now is rebuilding itself in like a semi-pseudo medieval Middle Eastern Dune-esque culture and mythology. And with, you know, some elements taken from the Byzantine Empire, some Sumerian ideas, like even some Egyptian hieroglyphic themes too. Miyazaki kind of just threw this amalgamation of all these different cultures into what the future would be if you're reducing what we have right now to complete ash. Basically.
Yeah. You mentioning the earthquake scene in The Wind Rises. I found it very interesting that at the end of the film, we see a very similar scene of the city after, you know, the bombs have hit pretty much. And it's like, what I feel like, you know, he was trying to say is that we have the same amount of power as Mother. Like, Mother Nature can destroy everything, but we also can do the same thing, like with what we've created. We are trying to play become God. Yeah,
they want to play God and toy with people's lives. And the common person just wants to like live, love, and, you know,
and
exist and live, love, and laugh. Well, and just coexist with one another and be on this planet and enjoy the time we have on this planet. But there's the powers that be, they want to just destroy. And in both these films, I think that's the message that Miyazaki's saying, is that we need to, like, really discuss not having these tools that will inevitably at some point destroy us. I mean, It's interesting because a lot of the films that came out during the 80s and early 90s in anime, you know, you have Ghost in the Shell, you have Akira, you had even, and of course, Nausicaa, they all deal with that post-apocalyptic what if scenario. And they all are a warning to either whoever's watching, we need to, like, not let this happen again ever, because the aftermath is not pleasant. So, millions of people lose their lives, you know.
Yeah,
beautiful souls.
Most definitely, it was interesting watching The Wind Rises, and being from America, the Japanese Zeros are looked at as, you know, one of the most evil things on Earth. In our because of what happened at Pearl Harbor and everything, and
though
it was so,
though we did coax the Japanese, I mean, we cut off their oil supply, and, you know, we did force them into the war because we wanted to go into the war because we needed to get out of the Depression. That was the only way to get out of
that's how we created all the jobs, and all the jobs became like working to create things for the war, which got us out of the Depression we were in.
Exactly.
But it was really interesting to see the story of how that plane came to be, to see, because it's all based on a true story.
Mm-hmm.
The Wind Rises is.
Yeah.
And
Jiro Hirokoshi's life. And in essence, it is a beautiful looking plane. It's like the design is insane. It's they really push the boundaries of technology with that design of airplane, because at the time, you know, Japan was struggling to find a worthy fighter plane to help protect their bombers and their navy, as well as their army and such. You know, unfortunately, they then used it to, you know, kill Americans. They used it to kill other nations too. But, you know, we did the same thing with our, you know, airplanes as well. And so were the Germans. That's unfortunately
it's war.
Yeah, that's the aftermath of what happens. Well, that's what happens with war. I think with Miyazaki, since he is a pacifist, and, you know, he's trying to give us a warning that we can't let this happen. And I think that's definitely evident. And also, it's with Nausicaa, starting with Nausicaa, has a very humanitarian message to it.
Yeah. Definitely.
It's like this very pseudo amalgamation of all different cultures in what could come after a nuclear holocaust, basically. And there's some beauty in that respect, but there's also a sadness too, because these people don't really have anything, but some do, you know, the have and the have nots.
The elites and the rich and the poor.
Right. And we see that between the Tremalians. Tolmikya is the nation that attacks the Valley of the Wind. Even after a post-apocalyptic event, they're still warring nations. It's like that, you know, sin will always be in man.
Yeah, and I think it's also that human beings have such a complex that we're never satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
We're, especially if you get power, you just want more power.
Right.
We're watching the dictator.
Yeah.
Was the dictator?
Yeah.
Yeah. Watching the dictator. I mean, there's a great example of it. When he was at the top and he's like, oh, you know, has his little nephew controlling the city, turning the lights on.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, more and more and more power. It's like that. It sounds cliche, but it's like that evil, maniacal, ooh, I want all the power.
Well, it's a very immature way to view the world, too. It's that whole, they haven't grown up. They haven't matured. And I think if you do mature and you do see the world and learn to understand the world, you know, even Rick Steves says, go travel and meet people and go see the world, because you have a better understanding of what your own place is in the world. And also, it's a big world, and there's a lot of people in it. And we got to learn to work with
it's
them.
It's a great big universe. And
it's a lot.
Really puny.
It's a
I was quoting Rob there.
I also thought what was interesting, they kind of predicted in a weird way, they also kind of predicted the use of masks to this day because of COVID, which I was like,
yeah,
hey, spores, killer spores. There's a, you know, nuclear, it's like nuclear fallout, I guess. But the spores are taking over the world and it's almost like a virus. Oh, it sounds kind of like COVID. Oh,
they had cooler masks, though.
They did. They did, actually. They kind of looked more steampunk-esque. So.
Yeah, I want to be like one of those knights, like in the full-on knight thing with the mask on. And come on, that was pretty cool.
Why do they have this like mix of like pikes and spears and swords,
automatic
and
weapons,
then automatic machine guns and stuff? Like, where did that come? But because it is a post-apocalyptic world, they would use, I think, anything they could get their hands on, and it could just be left over from, you know, other societies that were there before them, and or passed down through generations and stuff, because, you know, they make the swords kind of out of anything, any materials that they could find in the world. I mean, and that's what you would do if, you know, the worst happens and you don't have a grocery store or, you know, you don't have a place to get your weapons
at. Super Walmart.
There's no Walmart. Weapons R Us anymore. So, you know, but.
Well, another thing that we talked about, and you kind of touched on it earlier, was how it influenced so many, you know, other projects. And we were talking about, the knights were basically the stormtroopers, and then the other group were the rebels, because they literally looked like rebels.
Well, Star Wars came out before this, so I think Miyazaki was trying to do his kind of epic in a way, because he wrote the manga first of Nausicaä, and then he went on to direct the feature film. Because at the time, he started out in between animation artist at Toei Animation, and then formed Studio Ghibli after he directed Nausicaä, the Valley of the Wind. And he really probably was influenced by a lot of Western culture, because Japan was getting a lot of Western culture influence after World War II. And whether that changed, you know, there was certain factions that wanted to stay in the past, you know, maintain their culture through their samurai viewpoint and keep certain traditions alive still. But then another, the more modern generation that came up after, like, that kind of basically were born in the war, during the war, and then grew up through the war and saw the aftermath, they kind of adapted more of the Western culture because they saw what their parents went through during the war and wanted to kind of move on from it and embrace more of other cultures and embrace more of the world that was open up to them. That influence of Lucas, I see that in George Lucas, I see that in Hayao Miyazaki, especially in Nausicaä, because it's, as you said, the stormtroopers are basically the knights and the rebels are the people of the Valley of the Wind. So,
yeah,
you know, and they don't try to hide it, like the design. And then, of course, the princess looks like Mega Man, as you said.
We had some great conversations about that character.
Yeah, it's the forerunner of Mega Man. Thanks, Nintendo. So,
yeah, very cool, Nintendo. Very cool.
Very cool. But
and then another thing that you were mentioning earlier about, you know, films that were influenced, things like that. One that I attributed it to was How to Train Your Dragon.
Yeah,
because you have the people that are not in the Valley of the Wind that are like, oh, these monsters are evil. No, no, we can't be friends with them.
Of course.
And
you have
the princess is like, no, wait. And that's Hiccup, of course, you know.
And then
like,
somehow has some special ability that allows him to, or her, to commune with nature.
Yeah. And then you have her useless pet that does nothing but look cool.
That looks kind of like Jolteon or Eevee from Pokemon. But, you know, it's there as a centerpiece, Trevor. So
yeah, but it doesn't do anything the whole time.
It just bites her finger at the beginning, and then it's like, oh, okay, you're just here to sell toys and
Yeah, literally. I mean, by the
merchandising,
end of,
merchandising,
where,
you know?
Yeah. You were telling me, you're like, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a part where, like, it does, like, some super cool, like, powers.
I was hoping.
And stuff.
I kind of vaguely remember, like, because it's been so long since I had seen it. And I'm like, oh, well, I'm sure there's a point to having this character in here.
Well, spoiler alert.
Spoiler,
there is no point.
There is no point, guys.
It's cute.
It's cute, though.
That's about it.
It looks good on her shoulder. So.
It's crazy, man.
You know, despite all the kind of setup that Nausicaä has done for other films, also draws upon some of the sci-fi at the time. Dune, really, I see a heavy influence of Frank Herbert's Dune in this film, because look at the design of the Ohms. The Ohms look like
the
worms,
yeah, exactly.
from Dune itself. And, you know, I think Miyazaki, again, that shows his influence from Western culture, that he is taking all these things that he's reading or watching and seeing around the world. And even in the music itself, you have a blending of synth and orchestral elements in there, and it sounds so 80s, man. I'm like,
it's almost like a Zelda-esque type,
right? Has a video game feel,
yeah,
to it. It's really interesting, because like there's certain elements that stick out more as you watch it more and stuff. So this time, like, I was more in tune with like more of the sound stuff, because it's like, oh, okay, that's sticking out like a sore thumb, sort of. So not so much on The Wind Rises, though. The Wind Rises, it was, I felt the soundscape and the sound design and music really blended wonderfully together, and nothing
so good
stood out, you know. And I think Miyazaki really got to the point where he knew how to use those elements together and blend the beauty of really what we hear as children and then what we try to achieve as adults. That whole passage of time is just beautifully captured in animation in The Wind Rises.
And The Wind Rises, basically, what's his name again?
Jiro.
I keep forgetting his name. Jiro?
Jiro.
Yeah.
Like Jiro, Jiro dreams of sushi, but it's Jiro dreams of zeros.
Jiro basically. Oh my gosh, it's right. Oh my gosh, I just caught that moment. Jiro basically goes from living a dream to it turning into a nightmare.
And yeah,
by the end,
it's almost like he, as a person, goes into the fantasy realm and of, you know, meeting his mentor, forgot the French aircraft designer that he keeps meeting up with in his dreams, that kind of gives him guidance through his life at certain moments and helps him to then develop the design for one of the fastest airplanes that the Japanese military had. You know, I found it interesting that he kept going back to those dream worlds, because it's him trying to escape the reality of what he's doing actually is affecting people's lives around him. And also the fact that, you know, if your wife is dying, why? I mean, I get people throwing themselves into work, but a part of me was like, she's dying, like,
was dying of something that has no cure.
Right. And he chose to really, I mean, thankfully she supported his work, but all that lost time that he could have spent instead of designing the plane, he could have spent with his wife. You know, some people have different different motivations for their lives and stuff, but I don't know. Like I caught that on this time around watching it. It was like, oh, wow. It's kind of sad, but I'm like, dude, you tried to spend, but not, I would have just been like, well, I'll take a desk job or whatever, you know, just be there for the wife and everything. So
yeah, and it all kind of culminates in that moment at the very end where she says, just live.
Yeah.
And that's what he hasn't been doing. That's when he finally realizes, like, I don't know if he realizes it's wasted time. Because it's not wasted time. He completed an incredible feat, right? Creating that plane. But he took so much time to do it that he lost.
Well, for her, I think she was thinking that's his, he's following his dream. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't, I mean, she even, the wife just literally, well, actually, I'm not going to spoil it. I shouldn't spoil it. So, because it's really sad what she does, because,
yeah,
you know, she just feels like, oh, well, his
she
dream,
feels like a burden. Dream,
yeah, it's a sad thing, because no, every life is sacred. You know, you need to live your life and just enjoy the time you have with your family or your loved ones and
friends, loved ones. Yeah,
yeah, friend, loved ones. Yeah. And it's just, you know, I it has like a very sad, it ends on like a sad note. I'll just spoilers, guys, but it does end on a sad note. Mm-hmm. So, but if you want more of a happy note, watch Nausicaä.
Yeah, if you want to see like a Mega Man-esque type individual just go ham on some things.
Well, and also it's almost like a feminist epic heroine that just totally destroys, has superpowers and can talk to nature and will save the world.
Yeah, and before, there's one thing we haven't talked about yet, yes. Elliot. Ozu's influence on yes. The Wind Rises.
Yes.
See, I got you. I knew you wanted to bring okay. that up.
I forgot to bring this up, but
I'll let you take it away.
All right. Well, so with The Wind Rises, Miyazaki, in multiple shots throughout the film, especially when he sets up the shots of Jiro at home in his house and everything, and also how he builds his characters, has a very Yasujiro Ozu vibe to it. And the framing is exactly like Ozu. And
the
just without
shots,
just
all
with
the tee
just
shots.
With color, all the tee shots, it's just with color and it's animated. We're talking about animation that almost looks like live action at some points, mm-hmm. especially how he does the watercolored skies. Oh my god! And it's just
beautiful. What I love.
It's like a beautiful painting that Miyazaki paints with through animation. And that's the ultimate stamp of an auteur director. And yeah, I think Miyazaki really carved that out for himself throughout his career.
I think you nailed it. One of the biggest things I noticed about The Wind Rises is that it's basically like the characters are on a canvas, mm-hmm. but they're moving across the canvas while the canvas stays to whatever it's been painted for that scene. Right. Kind of like what Ozu did, right? He would set the camera down mm-hmm. and let people just live in the space.
Right.
With The Wind Rises, they're living in the space, but it's a totally different medium in a totally different way. And it's beautiful.
But they're
it's
being absolutely thrown around by the elements that are mm-hmm. in the space around them that they're confined to in the cell. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Ozu really started that whole movement, and I think it just trickles down into Miyazaki, because I don't see much of Kurosawa influence in Miyazaki's work, except possibly in Princess Mononoke, because it's an action epic, and it had a very Western culture vibe, and Kurosawa really tried to push Japanese cinema into the Western markets. Ozu was more of a indie, like, I'm going to stick to very traditional framing and shot style and character development, but talk about issues that Japan itself is going through internally. And Miyazaki then just kind of took that and expanded on it. But, you know, Miyazaki's like kind of like the modern anime auteur director that's out there. Mm-hmm. And I have not seen, you know, like, there haven't been many directors like Miyazaki that have come out in the past century that really have a strong voice on the issues that they want to tackle during their lifetime and what we should be talking about and what we should be addressing.
Yeah. And I think that just leads us to one of the biggest things I think we both learned about this. Just go outside, get some fresh air, be thankful for another day on this mm-hmm. earth, and take care of yourself and also the planet that we call home.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's what Miyazaki would say, I do believe. If you like this episode, make sure to follow us on social media at Film Detectives for further news and upcoming shows. Join us next week as we explore filmmakers from around the world.
Imagine earning a degree that prepares you with real skills for the real world. Capella University's programs teach skills relevant to your career, so you can apply what you learn right away. Learn how Capella can make a difference in your life at capella.edu.
We all know Kit Kat bars taste delicious, but what about how they sound? It's not just a catchy jingle. It's the satisfying crack of breaking off a piece of Kit Kat, followed by a crisp crunch. Oh, we forgot one other sound that accompanies Kit Kat bars, too. It's... Or maybe it's more like... Altogether, Kit Kat bars are music to our ears and yummy flavors to our mouths. Have a break. Have a Kit Kat.